Welcome to the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. We hope our broadcast will bless you.
I invite you to turn with me to a call to worship this morning, which is reading number 876 on the back of your hymnal. I'd invite you to read with me in the dark print, and I'll read the light print. Where two or three meet in my name, I shall be there with them. The hour will come. In fact, it is here already, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. That is the kind of worshiper the Father wants. God is the Spirit, and those who worship must worship in spirit and truth. This time, I invite you to kneel as we seek the Lord in prayer. It's our custom in Midland to invite those that have special needs or requests or would like to come forward to pray with us up at the front. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to come into your house this morning and to worship you. We recognize that it's a privilege to come before you, and we ask that you open our hearts and make us responsive to your word that we're about to hear. We ask that you remember those that are not here with us this morning. We have those among us that are ill and sick and have other difficulties, and we ask that you be with them. We ask you be with those that have emotional difficulties and other heartaches that make it difficult for them to be here this morning, and that you remember them especially. We ask that you remember those in other parts of the world that are also worshiping you. In some parts of the world, there's not the freedom to worship you that we have here, and we thank you for this opportunity. As we prepare to listen this morning, help us to become especially responsive to what we're to hear and to apply it in our lives as we go out in the rest of the world later in the week. In your name, amen.
Time for the children's story.
Good morning. I have something here in this bag that I'm going to show you, but before I do, I want to ask you some questions. Do you sometimes ever see somebody and they're really dressed nicely and you think, that's a really nice person? Have you ever had that happen? Have you ever seen somebody that sometimes you thought was a really nice person and then when you got to know them, you found out they weren't very nice at all afterwards? Have you ever seen somebody that's not dressed very well or doesn't look very nice or looks really grumpy and maybe they're frowning all the time? And then after you get to know them, you find out they're really, really nice. You just have to get to know them a little bit. Any of you have an Easter egg hunt this year? Did you decorate the eggs? What, did you help decorate the eggs, or did you just look for them? That's a lot of fun, isn't it? What color did you make your eggs?
I made some blue and some red and some half-colored ones, but my Uncle Paul and my dad helped, and my mama, too.
That's good. Well, I have some eggs here today, Easter eggs. And we didn't decorate these eggs. They're just eggs, and they kind of all look about the same. But there's something different about some of these eggs. Before you decorated your eggs, did you do anything to your eggs?
We boiled them.
Why did you boil them?
For they wouldn't be so easy to break.
Yeah, and when you boil them, it changes the insides of them, doesn't it? And it makes them harder, and you can eat them. If you had a egg that was raw, it wouldn't be very, very good that way, would it? Now, some of these eggs here have been boiled, and some of them haven't. Can you tell which ones have been boiled? Well, there's a way you can actually tell without breaking them open, because, of course, if you broke them open, you could tell if they were boiled. If they're not boiled, then the insides are all kind of gooey, and they wobble back and forth. And if they're boiled, they're all kind of solid. So if you take an egg like that, you see how it kind of wobbles a little bit? That tells me that one's probably not been boiled. If you take one of the other ones, yeah, maybe that's another one too that's not been boiled. But you take this one, you see how you can spin it and it stops right away? So you can tell the difference? Should we see if we're right or not? We'll see. See, this one's just a hard-boiled egg. See, there's not in there. But one of these ones, if we break it open, see how it makes a big mess? Well, it's the same thing when you go to Sabbath school and church. When you hear about Jesus and you learn about him, it changes something on the inside, doesn't it? And it makes you be a better person. And maybe when something bad happens to you, you react a little differently than if you hadn't learned about Jesus. You can go back to your seats.
Dr. Beetz will be referring to some of the things which I put in here as part of the text. One of them he'll be using is Matthew, the 17th chapter, verses 24 through 27. Matthew 17, 24 and 27. And this is what the scriptures say. When they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he had come to the house, Jesus answered him, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers?" Peter said to him, "From strangers." Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and for you." In Romans 14, verses 1 through 3, it says this: "Receive one who is weak in the faith, but not in disputes over doubtful things. For one believes that he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats only vegetables. Let not him that eats despise him who does not eat, and let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has received him." And 9 and 10. "For to this end Christ died and rose and lived again, that he might be the Lord of both the dead and the living. But why do you judge your brother? Or why do you show contempt for your brother? For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ."
You're driving along the road at the speed limit, and some nut comes right up behind you driving really fast, and before you can think about moving out of the way, he's flashing his lights and tooting his horn. You contemplate slowing down, but knowing that that would not demonstrate the matchless church of Christ, you speed up a little bit and slowly drift into the other lane. He zooms past you, accelerating to 90 miles an hour, and kind of waves at you as he goes by, not using all of his fingers. 5 miles down the road, you see him again, parked beside the road in front of a car with flashing red lights. And sure enough, one of California's finest is standing next to his car with ticket book in hand. And you gloat. Or as Webster defines it, you gaze with malicious pleasure. You are tempted to slow down a little bit and toot your horn and wave back at him as you go by. Serves him right, the idiot. It feels right to be right. It feels good. Others get what they deserve, and it just makes us feel good. You have an argument with your spouse about the time change. Is there more darkness in the morning when we get up, or is there more light? And when morning comes, you're right, and you gaze with malicious pleasure. You may even say, "I won't say I told you so," which is exactly the same as saying, "I told you so," with a touch of humility tossed in. See, it feels good to be right. You're on rounds. A question is asked about the patient that stumps everyone. But you happen to have read a recent article about that particular problem, and you provide a footnoted answer, and everyone is impressed. And you feel good. To be right can make you feel so righteous, particularly if other people notice. In fact, if they don't notice, then it's no fun at all. I received a long letter once. "I simply do not believe you, that you claim to have written me 4 letters. I go to the file, and there I find copies of the 4 letters along with the return receipt of the certified letter with their signature on it. I'm right, and I gloat." You've been telling your friends all season that the New York Giants are the best team. And you knew they would beat Dallas. No one believed you, but today, you gloat. It feels good to be right. You are right, they are wrong, your team is better than their team, my daddy can beat up your daddy. And from the beginning of life's insecurities, we have the need to be better than, smarter than, richer than, stronger than, more right than. Now, it's one thing to be right about your football team or about when the time changes, because if I'm right or wrong about my football team, the consequences are slight. I can be right or wrong about the time change, and the consequences may be that I'll be late to work or early to work. But when it comes to religion, my faith, well, to be wrong about that is maybe to go to hell. The stakes are really high. Getting it wrong about the best football team is one thing. Getting it wrong about God, well, that's something else again. Have you ever been in a religious debate or discussion, an argument with someone about religious beliefs? Heartbeat tends to go a little faster. Your blood pressure rises. The stakes are high. It's important to be right. I Googled the truth about Seventh-day Adventists. I received 350,000 hits. A sampling of a page. Articles by ex-Seventh-day Adventists about why the teachings of Ellen White and the Adventist Church are not in accord with the Bible. Second most important thing Seventh-day Adventists need to know is that your church has not told you the whole truth. Not exactly the kind of material I enjoy reading. Tends to raise the anxiety, the blood pressure, because here's someone that thinks they're right and I think I'm right. And it's really an important issue. I remember at my first pastorate, studying with some people, and it so happened one of the times I went to study with them, there were some missionaries of another religious persuasion there, and we were competing for the attention of these people and arguing about the truth or falsity of our particular perspective, and I made a point that they had no answer for, and I felt that sense of righteous power, gloating. The religious rulers at the time of Christ had that feeling a lot. They lived their lives making watertight case for their religion by Talmudic arguments and counterarguments. I think they frequently felt like I might feel driving by the policeman standing there giving the ticket to the guy beside the road. I think they frequently felt like I might feel when I read the article on some cult and feel smug as I see the author tear their religion apart and tie it in Gordian knots. Now, it's important to be right. I don't deny that. I mean, the other option would be to be wrong, and there's no reason to pursue that. So we should seek to be right, whether it comes to daylight saving time or even choosing the right football team, and especially when it comes to religion. Religious belief, it's vital to seek after truth, because religious belief is the heart of our being. It's the heart of our life. Having the truth is good. Being right is good. But it's also dangerous. For being right can lead to gloating. The story goes that at Comdex Computer Expo, Microsoft Bill Gates compared the computer industry to the auto industry and stated if GM had kept up with a technology like the computer industry has, we would be all driving $25 cars that got 1,000 miles per gallon. General Motors responded to Gates by releasing a statement, yes, but would you want your car to crash twice a day? We want to be right and have the right answers. Last night I was driving home from Laguna Beach and I have this GPS in the car and it tells you, you know, when to turn. And it told me to turn. And so I did, and I was going the wrong direction on the San Diego freeway. Fortunately, the GPS doesn't gloat. It just says, recalculating, recalculating. I heard a story on television this morning about a guy who followed the instructions of his GPS. It said, turn right onto the railroad tracks. And he did, and the train destroyed his car. Being right, all the time right, can result in being a Pharisee. Remember, it was the religiously robed, recently washed, truth-filled, Bible-believing church leaders who gathered in committee to discuss how they might kill Jesus. Why would they do that? Well, they Googled sayings of Jesus and found stuff like, "Woe unto you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites." Their righteousness was challenged. It didn't feel good. So they sat down in the Protect the Truth Committee, planning how they could catch Jesus. What would they do this time? A clever young lawyer had an idea. You know, we've been aiming at the wrong target, he said. Why don't we, when you want to capture a king, you attack the pawns. We need to confuse his followers and place a question in their minds. The young lawyer continued with everyone's attention. So as to not raise suspicions, let's have the temple secretary ask one of the disciples why Jesus doesn't pay the temple tax. Oh yes, good idea, one of the Pharisees saw the trap. If he pays the temple tax, he admits he's not a religious teacher or a prophet. If he doesn't pay the temple tax, then he's disloyal to the temple. So the plot is laid and impulsive Peter is selected for the hook. Peter, the temple secretary calls. Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? Peter, not thinking through all the issues that were involved, figured they were suggesting that Jesus was somehow disloyal to the temple. And so he quickly replied, "Why, yes, he does. He pays the temple tax." The temple tax collector replies, "Well, you know, we don't have any records here of him paying the tax." Peter probably started to argue about the sloppy record keeping that was going on in the temple, and the temple tax collector probably argued back that they recently had been audited and the records were in fine shape, and Peter probably argued back, "Well, yeah, so were Enron's, and you know, it could have gone on forever." The exchange was very heated. Finally, to be justified, to be proven that he was right, Peter goes to the house where Jesus is teaching to get a receipt to prove that Jesus paid the temple tax. But before he has a chance to ask Jesus, Jesus says, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of earth collect duty and taxes? From their own sons or from others?" Peter, always quick to respond, replied, "Well, from others." "Then the sons are exempt," Jesus said to him. So Peter receives his answer before he asks the question. And now it is the Pharisees who can gloat. Jesus is exempt from the temple tax. because of his spiritual claims. He is a prophet. And then Jesus says, but so we may not offend them, go to the lake, throw out a line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and for yours. But Jesus, Peter might have objected, it's not right for you to pay the tax. You just said the sons are exempt. You are exempt. And Jesus says, we will pay the tax that we may not offend them. Let's not offend. But we are right. Let's not gloat. But we have the truth. Let's not press the case. But we can win. Peter would not hesitate in offending someone if he knew he was in the right. Whether it was calling fire down from heaven on a Samaritan village like James and John wanted to do, or cutting off the ear of the servant of the high priest like Peter would later do, Peter was right. He knew it and everyone else knew about it, and he loved to gaze in malicious pleasure. Peter was confused. Jesus was making a concession to the temple tax collecting Pharisees. He was doing something he didn't have to do. He paid the bill that he didn't owe. He was slapped and he turned the other cheek. He stopped his car and paid the fine of the speeding driver that almost drove him off the road. Jesus was right, but he chose not to make an issue out of it. He chose not to offend. Jesus was right, but he wouldn't flaunt it. He wouldn't gloat. Jesus was right. He was always right. He was God, after all. The lesson Jesus wanted to teach was as much for Peter as it was to keep the slippery lawyers a few steps away from nailing him to the cross. Jesus didn't come to condemn, but to save. Jesus didn't come to prove that he was right, but to give righteousness to us. He came not to show off his righteousness. He came not to impress us with his wisdom. He came to make us wise unto salvation. Our rightness, our righteousness, is a gift to strengthen others, not an asset to feed our pride. We must be careful when we are right, for there's something dangerous about being right. It can create a sense of selfish superiority. It can lead to righteously robed lawyers manipulating religious words and texts with legalese. When being right is more important than being sensitive to human needs, when holding to right church policies is more important than people, when being right is more important than being righteous, then we've taken rightness as our gospel instead of Jesus. Then we've made a God of the truth instead of Jesus. Jesus was right. He was not obligated to pay the temple tax. But so we may not offend them, Peter, go and pay it anyway. It is the self-centered individualism of our culture that seeks to offend and offends so quickly, because we need to be number one, we need to be first, we need to be right. When I'm the center of a universe and my needs are the most important needs, I don't care if I cut you off on the freeway, because I deserve to be first. A few months ago, I went to a doctor's office. I had outlined my day's activities with great specificity. I had appointments to keep. I had this material to pick up at the doctor's office. I had something to stop at the, you know how your list is, your to-do list. It was a long list. And I made it to the doctor's office when it opened. The receptionist was there. She acted like I wasn't there. I almost said, do you know who I am? I'm important. I need this now. It's really important. But she was pretending like she didn't know who I was. We can get so self-pumped up with our schedules, our itineraries, our to-do lists to feel like we are the most important thing in the universe. Such arrogance can be a national disease where our country believes it is so right it can offend other nations. Such arrogance can be a church disease where our church believes it is so right it can be offensive. Such arrogance can be a personal disease resulting in egotism and pride. It's so easy to get caught up in ourselves. Why do we stand in line to be the first one on our block to get an iPhone, if not to gloat? I have an iPhone. Why do we pay more for the brand that's no better than the generic, if not to gloat? I mean, I looked at the coat I put on this morning. Calvin Klein? Who's that? And why does he put his name on my jacket? And why do I pay more for it? Because he has his name on it. We can be caught up with symbolisms of trying to always be number one, be right, be more important. A pastor was officiating at a funeral, and when he was done, he was asked to lead the funeral procession as it made its way to the cemetery. So he got into his car and started driving at the head of the funeral procession. In his mind, I'm sure he was thinking about the quality person he was and the great job he did at this funeral. And he flipped on his radio and he was preoccupied and he was lost in thought and forgot where he was going. About that time, he passed a Kmart and he thought about something he needed to pick up. You know where this is going. So he turned into the parking lot, and as he was looking for a parking place, he happened to glance in his rearview mirror and saw a string of cars following him with their lights on. Lost in selfish thought, the danger of being right, the danger of pride and selfishness. For the church, it is a danger of gathering into enclaves of truth where we gloat our way to hell, gazing with malicious pleasure as we stand in the church, thanking God we are not like those other folks who worship on the wrong day and eat those disgusting things. When we have righteousness that comes from Jesus, we can, rather than self, we can be secure. We don't have to prove anything. When our rightness is because it's God's gift, then it's something we can give to others rather than to use to build up ourselves. Paul knew he was right. He knew that it meant nothing to eat food that had been offered to idols. He could eat it with a clear conscience. He was right. Others were wrong whose conscience was bothered by eating such food. But he didn't use his freedom to gloat. He said, be careful that the exercise of your freedom does not become a stumbling block to the weak. If what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again so that I will not cause him to fall. So Peter, pay the tax so we won't offend. It does no good to believe right things and be an offense to people, for one commandment trumps all others. As Paul says, love your neighbor as yourself. There's no commandment greater than these. I have a question. Would you rather live next door to a loving atheist or an offensive Christian? Would you rather be a loving Muslim or an offensive Christian? There are those who have elevated what they believe over how they behave. What is the point of our doctrines if it doesn't make us live differently and more lovingly? What is the point of the church if it isn't to show the matchless charms of Christ to our communities? At the great judgment day, when the sheep are separated from the goats, it's not based on creedal statements. It's based on what we've done for our neighbor. As James says, what good is it, dear brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith and don't show it by your actions? Can that kind of faith save anyone? You have faith, for you believe there is one God. Good for you. The demons believe this, and they tremble in terror. There's the danger of being right, using our rightness as a badge of honor rather than a badge of service. Instead of finding common ground with our neighbor, we look for battlegrounds. It's like the man I met once who asked me on the street what religion I was. I told him Seventh-day Adventist, and he opened his briefcase and he shuffled through some files and he pulled out a tract against Seventh-day Adventist. Paul says in Romans 14:15, if your brother is distressed because of what you eat, you're no longer acting in love. The greater my focus on my rightness, on my righteousness, the less my ability to be loving. Once upon a time, in Fenton Forest, Sweet Pea the skunk, basket in hand and daisy propped above her ear, was waiting for the nut hut to open. She wanted to be the first one there today because there was a special sale on chocolate-dipped almonds, and no one liked chocolate-dipped almonds better than Sweet Pea. Unless, of course, it was her good friend Freddy the Fox. She was going to be the first one in the store today because Scamper's advertisement said supplies were limited and chocolate almonds would be available only as long as they lasted. She wanted to buy some to give to Freddy. The two of them had been friends ever since Freddy had rescued one of her children from Slippery Rock right by Crashing Creek. As she stood on the big root by the door of the Nut Hut, who should come by but Freddy the Fox? Freddie stopped suddenly with a surprised look on his face and said to Sweet Pea, what are you doing here today? The Nut Hut doesn't open till 9:30. Oh, no, replied Sweet Pea. It opens at 9 o'clock. Oh, no, it doesn't. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. They argued back and forth. Well, we'll just see, said Freddie. It's almost 9 o'clock now, and I will just wait with you, and you'll see that I am right. Okay, you wait, and you will see that I am right, said Sweet Pea. 9 o'clock came, and Scamper did not show up to unlock the door. Freddy began to smile the smile of the smug. 5 minutes passed, and Scamper didn't show up. Freddy began to gloat. 15 minutes passed, and Scamper still didn't show up. All the time, Freddy and Sweet Pea's friendship continued to deteriorate as they argued about who was right. Finally, close to 9:30, Scamper bounced up the narrow worn path to the porch of the Nut Hut immediately. Both Sweet Pea and Freddy said in unison, when does the Nut Hut open today? You want those chocolate-covered almonds, don't you? Replied Scamper. Well, it opens in just a few minutes at 9:30, just like it said in the advertisements. See, gloated Freddy as he danced a little jig and sang, I'm right, I'm right, I'm right. I told you so, I told you so. Well, said Sweet Pea, I'm not going to wait that long for chocolate almonds. They probably are old anyway. And Sweet Pea walked away in a stink. Wise old Owl, who had been watching all from a tree limb, said, gloating over being right may not only lose you your friends, but chocolate almonds as well. It feels good to be right, but being right is God's gift, not our work, to be used to build His kingdom. Not our importance. Eternal Father in heaven, we thank you for the gift of knowledge, for the gift of your word, for the gift of grace, for the gift of the precious charms that we are to manifest to our neighbors, not to be displayed on our mantle of goodness, but used to draw people to you. In the name of your Son, we ask these things. Amen.
Father, help us to remember the dangers of being right and of gloating. Help us to keep these thoughts in our minds as we go out through this week. In your name, amen.
You have been listening to the broadcast from the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church at 2420 East Ashman in Midland, Michigan. If you are in the area, we cordially invite you to visit our church Saturday mornings. If you are a distance away, we encourage you to continue visiting our website and weekly podcast at midlandsda.org.